The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we'll be reading the edition dated February 10th, 2012 from The Week magazine. And we'll first turn to the main story section. Our first item is entitled, A More Combative Romney is Back on Top. What happened? Mitt Romney reclaimed his status as the frontrunner for the Republican presidential nomination last week, crushing Newt Gingrich by 14 points in the Florida primary. The former Massachusetts governor regained his momentum by going on the attack against Gingrich, aggressively questioning his ethics in two debates and saturating local media with $15.4 million in negative ads. The focuses of Romney's attacks were the former House Speaker's $1.6 million in consulting fees from the mortgage giant Freddie Mac, and the ethics scandal that ended his tenure as Speaker. Gingrich had won South Carolina on January 21st with his own assault on Romney's tenure running a venture capital company. But in Florida, he was outspent by nearly 5-to-1 margin. About 92% of political advertising overall in Florida was negative, leading media tracker Kantar to label it the most negative campaign ever. A visibly angry Gingrich vowed to fight on until this summer, reminding the elite media that voters in 46 states had yet to cast ballots in primaries or caucuses. It's now clear that this will be a two-person race between the conservative leader and the Massachusetts moderate, he said. But Romney went into February with $20 million on hand, compared with the $2.1 million for Gingrich, who's relied heavily on a single super PAC donor. Romney said he welcomed the long fight ahead. A competitive primary does not divide us, it prepares us, he said. Now here's what the editorials had to say. What a bloodbath, said the Wall Street Journal. The kicking and eye gouging wasn't pretty, but by giving Gingrich a sound beating, Romney finally showed conservatives the kind of backbone that he'll need for the inevitable cage match with President Obama in the general election. Gingrich has only himself to blame for this resounding defeat, said the Boston Herald. When Romney quite accurately called Newt an influence peddler for taking Freddie Mac's money while the lender was inflating the housing bubble, Gingrich proved he can throw a punch but can't take one. He stammered and turned even whinier than usual, like a bully who'd been punched in the nose. Romney, however, can't just sit on his lead, said USA Today. Exit polls show that conservatives who strongly identify with the Tea Party still prefer Gingrich to him. Not only does Romney have to unite the establishment and Tea Party wings of his party, but he has to do so without alienating the independent voters who will decide the November election. Thanks to the GOP candidates' exchange of brutal personal attacks, just 22% of independents now view Romney favorably, while 42% see him unfavorably. And now here's what the columnist said. Romney's inevitability has been restored, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. Republicans who identified the ability to beat Obama as the key issue supported Romney 58% to Gingrich's 32%. Romney also had a large margin of victory among women and Hispanics, two groups Republicans can't afford to alienate in November. By shedding his clean-cut Boy Scout Ken Doll image, said John Podhoretz in NewYorkPost.com, Romney proved that he'd be willing to show real toughness, even meanness, in taking on Obama. This primary race is all but over. It really is difficult to see how Gingrich can come back from this defeat, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. After Romney directly challenged his ethics in debates, Gingrich looked morose and deflated. That undermines the strongest rationale for his candidacy, which was that he alone has the rhetorical chops to stand toe-to-toe with President Obama. Without his debating magic, Gingrich doesn't have any cards left to play. Try telling him that, said Fred Barnes in WeeklyStandard.com. Gingrich was defiant in the wake of losing Florida, promising a comeback in the procession of primaries in conservative states over the next month. That's not entirely out of the question. Romney hasn't found the right vocabulary or tone to appeal to movement conservatives, relying on promises to unleash the genius and creativity of the American people while saving the soul of America. Huh? That sounds more like something Obama would say. Until Romney can unite Republicans behind substantive proposals for shrinking government and reviving the economy, Gingrich will be snapping at his heels. And, of course, this is the news as of press time last week at the Week magazine. As you know, the Republican presidential race just got a little more interesting this week. On Tuesday night, former Senator Rick Santorum, the Republican from Pennsylvania, scored stunning upset wins in the Colorado and Minnesota caucuses and in Missouri's non-binding beauty pageant primary. It was a clean sweep that nobody saw coming. As recently as a week ago, Mitt Romney was expected to win all three contests, and political analysts expected him to win Colorado, even as the votes were being tallied. That's just an update so that you're current. I'm sure we'll have more detail and more analysis in the week on next week's program. And now our next item from the main story section, a showdown over Syria. Syria was rapidly descending towards civil war last week as government troops used tanks and heavy weapons to crush rebel strongholds on the outskirts of Damascus. Dozens of people were killed in fierce fighting between the army and rebels, whose ranks have been swelled by army defectors. Western and Arab states urged the UN Security Council to unite behind a resolution calling on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step aside and designate a deputy to hold talks with the opposition. We all have a choice, stand with the people of Syria and the region, or become complicit in the continuing violence there, said U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But Russia threatened to veto any U.N. action against Damascus, fearing it would open the door to military intervention, just as an Arab-backed resolution led to NATO airstrikes in Libya last year. The Kremlin won't budge, said Yagol Beinglass and Daniel Brody in the New York Times. Not only is the Assad regime a major importer of Russian arms, spending $700 million on weapons in 2010, but it also hosts Russia's only Mediterranean naval base, Tartus. While Russia has strong economic and strategic reasons to stand by the Syrian despot, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin especially relishes this diplomatic showdown as a chance to counter the West's influence in the Middle East and revive Russia's superpower status. Syria will pay a heavy price for Putin's grandstanding, said Peter Harling in foreignpolicy.com. If the UN resolution fails, the opposition will conclude that the world has forsaken them and that the regime can only be fought with its own methods. The 11-month revolt, which has claimed at least 5,400 lives, will become more brutal, emboldening the more thuggish components of Syria's many ethnic and religious groups. There's not much the West and its Arab allies can do to stop this catastrophe, said the economist. They will have to wait until Russia realizes that it can no longer prop up Assad's crumbling regime. The Kremlin might then back a deal offering Assad exile and immunity from prosecution. In the meantime, Western nations should help opposition groups by implementing sanctions and sending medical supplies. Such aid is modest and piecemeal, but at least it will not make things worse. Our next item in a related story, rising tensions with Egypt. Tensions between Egypt's military rulers and the U.S. government erupted into the open this past week as three Americans, including the son of U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, sought refuge in the U.S. Embassy in Cairo to avoid arrest. Egypt's generals, who have accused foreign hands of fomenting protests against their rule, have launched a criminal investigation into U.S.-backed pro-democracy organizations and barred Sam LaHood and five other Americans from leaving the country. In response, U.S. officials told a high-level delegation of Egyptian military officers visiting Washington this week that the country's $1.3 billion in annual military aid could be suspended. The Muslim Brotherhood, whose political allies dominate the new parliament, have backed the military and clashed this week with protesters demanding an end to military rule. Targeting Americans is an extraordinary provocation, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Egypt's generals seem to believe U.S. military aid is an entitlement and that Washington will not dare cut them off. Preserving the alliance with Egypt may be a key U.S. interest, but when our citizens are subjected to xenophobic slanders and threatened with imprisonment, it's time to take an uncompromising stand. What did we expect? Asked Daniel Williams in Los Angeles Times. In the years since Hosni Mubarak was forced from power, much of his repressive legacy has been preserved and even strengthened. The euphoria of the revolution has faded in the face of widespread repression. It's now the job of the newly seated parliament to take the lead in ending the military's rule. But it may not be ready to do that, said Stephen Cook in ForeignAffairs.com. Cairo is rife with rumors of a deal between the Brotherhood and the generals. But while the two groups have nationalism in common, an alliance would not last. The military will not relinquish power without a fight, and as a new constitution is drafted in the coming months, the parliament will have to face down the generals. The current conflict points to a year of dispute and struggle. Now, from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. This week it's entitled, Apple Making iPhones by Exploiting Chinese Workers. And there's a question mark at the end of that statement. Looks like the Wizards of Cupertino have a few skeletons in the closet in China, said Thane Rosenbaum in the DailyBeast.com. Just as Apple's shareholders were celebrating record profits last week, $13.06 billion in just one quarter, the New York Times published an exposé describing how Chinese workers assembled the 37 million iPhones and 15.4 million iPads Apple sold in those 3 months. At the sprawling Foxconn plant in Shenzhen, an army of more than 200,000 workers puts the components together by hand, silently working 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, while standing up. Their pay, about $17 a day. They sleep in cramped corporate dormitories on side-by-side bunk beds. At least 19 Foxconn workers have killed themselves, most by throwing themselves off roofs. In response, factory bosses hung nets from roofs and balconies to deter jumpers. Apple customers face a stark moral dilemma, said Peter Cohen in Forbes.com. Do they keep buying and fetishizing Apple's sleek, miraculous products now that they know the human cost of making them? Or are they willing to boycott Apple to stop the carnage? If you really want to help the workers at Foxconn, said Tim Warstall, also in Forbes.com, go buy another iPhone. $17 a day is good money in China, which is why a million workers have gone to Foxconn and voluntarily signed up to work for those wages, assembling high-tech products for a slew of U.S. companies, including HP, IBM, and Dell. If you're going to boycott Apple, said Brooke Crothers in CNET.com, then you should boycott everything made in Chinese factories, including furniture, charcoal grills, nickel-cadmium batteries, and a host of other inexpensive consumer goods. The sad reality is that human-intensive mass production is ugly and always has been from the American Industrial Revolution to Japan's manufacturing boom in the 1960s. If you look inside any high-volume factory now or then, you'll get sick watching the sausage get made. Conditions need not be that ugly, said Heather Malik in the Toronto Star. Apple has gotten filthy rich from sweatshop labor, amassing $100 billion in available cash. Why not charge a little more for its products and spend that money improving the industrial hell of its Chinese contractors? The New York Times estimated that improving wages and conditions at Foxconn to U.S. standards would add only $65 to the average cost of an iPhone. Better still, said the Memphis Commercial Appeal in an editorial, bring those jobs back home. The company Steve Jobs founded in a garage once embodied the American dream. Now that it's the planet's richest tech company, Apple should charge its teams of geniuses with figuring out how to start producing machines made in America again. That's not going to happen, said Jordan Weissman in TheAtlantic.com. Manufacturing Apple products in the U.S. simply isn't possible, and not only because of labor costs. China has become a global hub of electronics manufacturing with a vast supply chain of factories making tiny screws, glass screens, and other crucial component parts. In addition, the U.S. lacks enough engineers with mid-level technical skills to oversee a high-tech production line like Apple's. China graduates 600,000 engineers every year, compared with 70,000 in the U.S. For better or for worse, the iPhone, the iPad, and the whole glittering array of Apple products will continue to be made in China. And now we'll turn to the popular column entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4 from the Week magazine. This week it was a good week for Toto after a Kansas state legislator introduced legislation that would make the Karen Terrier the breed of Dorothy's dog in The Wizard of Oz, as you may recall, the official state dog. And it was a good week for Al Green after President Obama sang the opening of Green's 1972 hit, Let's Stay Together, at a fundraiser at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Sales of the song zoomed nearly 500% with more than 16,000 downloads in a week. And it was a good week for the National Mustard Museum in Middleton, Wisconsin, which was saved from closure after it was granted an extra year to pay back a $200,000 loan. The museum houses 5,300 mustards from all 50 states and 60 countries. We want more people to come and have a good time, said the museum's curator. It was a bad week for stereotypes after a British study found that women are better at parking than men. Surveillance of 2,500 drivers found that women were better at finding spots, lining up their cars, and backing into parking spaces. Men were often impatient and sloppy parkers. And it was a bad week for fooling around after Pfizer recalled 1 million packages of birth control pills that had the 28-day sequence of pills mixed up, creating the possibility of unintended pregnancy. And you're listening to our reading of The Week magazine, the week dated February 10th, 2012. Thanks for joining me today. Now we will continue on with the people section of the this week's magazine. And the first item is entitled Carano's Fighting Spirit. Gina Carano was born to fight, said Roger Moore in the Dallas Morning News. I can take a punch. I was blessed with a very good jaw, says the mixed martial artist turned actress. And I'm hard-headed, literally, a hard melon. As a child, Carano, the daughter of former Dallas Cowboys quarterback, would provide the entertainment at family get-togethers. others. Sofas would be cleared from the living room, and little Gina would wrestle and beat her male cousins one by one. They were fascinated by how I could handle myself. In her early 20s, Carano took up Muay Thai kickboxing and realized she could make a career out of her violent talents. 5 months later, I found myself in a gym in San Francisco getting ready to fight another girl. She won the bout and went on to punch, kick, and choke her way to victory in cage fight after cage fight. Recently, her combat skills caught the attention of director Steven Soderbergh, who cast the 29-year-old in his action movie Haywire. But while fearless in the ring, Carano became a quivering wreck when asked to kiss co-star Michael Fassbender. My face was completely shaking, she says. I was going, oh my God. But it was nice. He was so genuine and so beautiful. The next item from the People section is entitled The Loneliness of the Long Distance Rower. Andrew Brown is a shy English toy company manager who has just broken the world record for rowing solo across the Atlantic, said Cole Morton in the London Telegraph. A keen sailor since childhood, the 26-year-old hadn't done much rowing before deciding to take part in the Talisker Atlantic Challenge. He proved his strength by rowing continuously for 25 hours on a machine, another record-breaking feat. Still, nothing could prepare him for the reality of 40 days alone at sea. I would get really down and start shouting, "Come on, Brown!" That was a bit weird. By the end of the journey, he'd lost 42 pounds and was almost delirious from lack of sleep. But Brown hadn't expected or wanted it to be easy. At 14, he'd been inspired by British yachtsman Peter Goss, who navigated the world solo. He had a problem with his elbow and had to perform do-it-yourself surgery. I remember reading about him sticking a mirror on his knee, holding the elbow above the mirror and cutting into it. I thought, what an incredible thing to do, to be out there all alone on the ocean and reliant on yourself. One day I would love to do something like that. He smiles. Obviously, it was the adventure I wanted, not necessarily the surgery. And our next item from the People's section, Nixon's Choice. Cynthia Nixon says she chose to become a lesbian, said Alex Wichell in the New York Times. I gave a speech recently to a gay audience, and it included the line, "I've been straight and I've been gay, and gay is better," says the Sex and the City star. They tried to get me to change it because they said it implies that homosexuality can be a choice. I understand that for many people it's not, but for me it's a choice, and you don't get to define my gayness for me. Nixon came out as a lesbian in 2004 after breaking up with childhood sweetheart Daniel Moses, with whom she has two children. She's now engaged to Christine Marinoni, who gave birth to their son last February. Both relationships, she insists, have been equally heartfelt. When I was in relationships with men, I was in love and in lust with those men. And then I met Christine, and I fell in love and lust with her. I am completely the same person. She rejects the idea that it's acceptable to be gay only if you have no choice in the matter. Why can't it be a choice? Why is that any less legitimate? It seems we're just ceding to this point to the bigots. Now, in this week's The Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section. This week's is entitled The Mayan Apocalypse. Did the ancient Mayans really predict that the world would end in 2012, as millions of people believe? Well, who were the Mayans? The Mayan civilization dates back to 2000 BC and extended through what is now southern Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador, and parts of Honduras. During the civilization's peak from AD 300 to 900, the Mayans not only built towering temples and pyramids, but also created elaborate astronomical maps and calendars and sophisticated mathematical systems. The civilization went into decline after 900, and its once teeming cities were soon abandoned. Historians dispute why this happened. Some say the Mayans were decimated by a 200-year drought, while others say they brought on their own downfall through over-farming. About 10 million descendants of the Mayans still live in Central America. Did the Mayans predict the end of the world? That belief is very much in dispute. The Mayan long count calendar progresses using a cycle of approximately 394 years known as a baktun. The calendar ends after the 13th baktun, which closes on December 21st of this year. A stone tablet recovered in Mexico in the 1960s made an oblique reference to a god of war descending from the sky at the end of the 13th baktun. That artifact has fed widespread theories that the world will end that day, and archaeologists last November identified an ancient brick fragment inscribed with what could be another reference to the same portentous date. Anthropologists unanimously agree that the Mayans saw time as cyclical and not linear. December 21st, 2012 simply represents the end of one cycle and the start of a new one. There is no concept of apocalypse in the Mayan culture, said Jesus Gomez, head of the Guatemalan Confederation of Mayan Priests. So why does the belief persist? Conspiracy theorists keep it alive, in many cases, for profit. Interest in the Mayan calendar dates back to the 1960s, when various New Age authors predicted that December 21, 2012, would usher in a new era of cosmic peace and understanding. But other fringe historians chose to see this date as Armageddon, and soon began to publish books linking the 13th Baktun with everything from Nostradamus to the lost city of Atlantis. In their book, The Mayan Prophecies, published in 1996, Maurice Cotterell and Adrian Gilbert claimed to have found evidence that the Mayans had predicted that solar activity would reverse the Earth's magnetic field in December 2012, destroying civilization and wiping out the human race. This idea spawned hundreds of books and tens of thousands of websites, all devoted to advancing the idea that the world would end in 2012. With the disaster movie 2012, even Hollywood got in on the fad. As the date itself approaches, doomsayers will renew their efforts. NASA says it is contacted by about 10 people every day asking about the end of the world, with some asking if they should kill themselves. How do the Mayans' descendants view the coming apocalypse? As a welcome business opportunity, Mexico's tourism industry anticipates a doomsday bonanza, with 52 million visitors expected to visit the states of Chiapas, Yucatan, Quintana Roo, Tabasco, and Campeche this year, more than twice the usual number for the whole of Mexico. Tapachula, a town on the Mexican border with Guatemala, has set up one of several doomsday clocks. More than 500 Mayan-themed events are scheduled throughout the region, including a sacred Mayan journey along the Yucatan Peninsula's Riviera Maya. Travel agent Johnny Channel says hotels were filling up quickly. "People are excited about it," she said. Are others profiting from doomsday fears? Opportunistic internet retailers are selling 2012 survival kits, insurance policies, and reserve seating in doomsday-proof bunkers. Californian Robert Viceno is peddling spaces in his private network of impervious underground survival shelters for $10,000 a head. What if the prophecies are true, he says on his website, which helpfully includes a countdown clock to the big day. Which side of the door do you want to be on? Retailers have also seen a mini boom in books, DVDs, and magazines explaining or debunking the myth. It's an amazing cottage industry, said Benjamin Radford, managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer. There are hundreds of titles out there, and we expect dozens more. Why so much interest? Prophets and charlatans have been predicting the end of the world for centuries, largely because people find that prospect exciting. Apocalyptic ideas thrive, especially when people feel marginalized or alienated from society, says cultural historian Paul Boyer. Believing the world will end creates a framework of meaning, he says, that gives our own personal lives some kind of significance. In the U.S., apocalyptic prophecies resonate with a public battered by recession and political strife, especially those raised as evangelical Christians. A Pew Center poll last year found that 41% of Americans believe the rapture will occur before 2050. America, in other words, is fertile soil for end times entrepreneurs. We invented this doomsday scenario, said archaeologist Catherine Reese Taylor, not the ancient Maya. How the end will come, that's the footnote column to this week's edition of the briefing. Well, those who believe the world will end this year have come up with various scenarios for global catastrophe. Massive earthquakes and tsunamis, the eruption of a supervolcano, and the sudden reversal of the Earth's poles. One of the more creative theories is that a rogue planet named Nibiru, or Planet X, is hidden behind the sun and will emerge and collide with Earth later this year. Another theory points to a planet named Eris. NASA has dismissed Nibiru as an internet hoax and explained that while a dwarf planet named Eris does exist at the edge of the solar system, its distant orbit precludes any collision with the Earth. Theories that a solar storm might affect Earth aren't as far-fetched. A severe solar storm occurred just last week, but NASA says solar flares do not pose an existential threat. There is no credible evidence for any of the assertions made in support of unusual events taking place in December 2012, NASA says. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. this week, according to the editors of the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Why Scandal Won't Sink Ron Paul, by David Weigel in Slate.com. Ron Paul's supporters are so enthusiastic, said David Weigel, that they cheerfully ignore everything that makes him look bad. Throughout his presidential campaign, Paul has insisted he knew nothing about the wildly racist, anti-Semitic, and homophobic rants that filled his Ron Paul newsletter in the 1990s. But the Washington Post last week provided new evidence that Paul has been lying. His former secretary, Renee Hathaway, told the Post that Paul always got to see the final product, while other aides and allies said Paul deliberately used an outreach to kooks and bigots strategy to solicit donations from white supremacists. So his newsletter stated, for example, that the 1992 Los Angeles riots ended when it came time for blacks to pick up their welfare checks, and that society was better off when homosexuals were forced to hide their activities. If Paul were a real contender, this bile would end his campaign overnight. But Paul's ragtag coalition of old right conservatives and young liberal college students could care less. They just want to keep their anti-drug war, anti-tax spokesman on the debate stage right next to Mitt Romney. The next column is entitled The Mormon Threat to Evangelicals by David Reynolds in NYTimes.com. Why do evangelical Christians have such a sour view of Mormons? Asked David Reynolds. The distaste is not purely theological. Christian scientists, Seventh-day Adventists, and dozens of other smaller sects also have strikingly different religious views from conservative Protestants, but they are rarely condemned as cults and false religions, as Mormonism often is. Simply put, evangelicals see the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as competition for souls and dues-paying members. Mormonism is one of the world's fastest-growing religions. Joseph Smith's tireless progeny have sent missionaries to 162 countries and now number some 14 million people worldwide. Evangelicals worry that a Mormon president would give a huge boost to all that aggressive proselytizing, especially a fervent one like Mitt Romney, who has tithed $4 million to the church in the last 2 years. But the Founding Fathers specifically set up America as a land of religious tolerance, where government would favor no sect nor oppress others. Religious competition has no place in our nation's politics. And the third column this week is entitled, Infidelity Tells Us Little About Leaders, by Victor Davis Hansen in NationalReview.com. By now, every voter knows that Newt Gingrich is a serial adulterer, said Victor Davis Hansen. Critics say that his personal moral failings would make Gingrich a less trustworthy, more erratic leader than the faithful Mitt Romney or Barack Obama. But history suggests otherwise. Many of history's greatest leaders cheated on their wives. Dwight Eisenhower, George Patton, and Martin Luther King Jr., to name just three. The philandering Bill Clinton and Franklin Roosevelt certainly were more effective presidents than loyal husbands Jimmy Carter and Richard Nixon. And New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was wooing his third wife while still married to wife number two when 9/11 occurred. Yet he proved steady and reliable in a way mayors more monogamous have not during their lesser disasters. The truth is that so many factors are crucial to skilled leadership that it's impossible to isolate one trait, even one as critical as fidelity, as an absolute barometer of future success. So when conservative voters favor Gingrich, they're not endorsing his marital history. They're acknowledging it matters less than how he would govern. And now we'll flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week to the section entitled The Last Word. And the title for this specific article is The Dangers of Fast Thinking. Our intuition is often wrong, says Daniel Kahneman, especially when we're searching for patterns and causes. Consider this. A study of the incidence of kidney cancer in 3,141 counties of the United States reveals a remarkable pattern. The counties in which the incidence of kidney cancer is lowest are mostly rural, sparsely populated, and located in traditional Republican states in the Midwest, the South, and the West. Now, what do you make of this information? Your mind has been very active in the last few seconds, and it was mainly operating in what I call System 2, the slow mode of thinking involved in effortful activities such as doing taxes, comparing two washing machines for best value, or driving in traffic. You deliberately searched memory and formulated hypotheses. Some effort was involved, your pupils dilated and your heart rate increased measurably, but System 1, the fast mode, which includes reacting to loud sounds, understanding simple sentences, and driving on empty roads, was not idle. You probably rejected the idea that Republican politics provide protection against kidney cancer. Very likely you ended up focusing on the fact that the counties with low incidence of cancer are mostly rural. The statisticians Howard Wehner and Harris Zwirling, from whom I learned this example, commented it is both easy and tempting to infer that their low cancer rates are directly due to the clean living of the rural lifestyle. No air pollution, no water pollution, access to fresh food without additives. This makes perfect sense. Now consider the counties in which the incidence of kidney cancer is highest. These ailing counties tend to be mostly rural, sparsely populated, and located in traditionally Republican states in the Midwest, the South, and the West. Wehner and Zwirling comment it is easy to infer that their higher cancer rates might be directly due to the poverty of the rural lifestyle, no access to good medical care, a high-fat diet, and too much alcohol, too much tobacco. Something is wrong, of course. The rural lifestyle cannot explain both the very high and the very low incidence of kidney cancer. The key factor is not that the counties were rural or predominantly Republican. It is that rural counties have small populations, and the main lesson to be learned is not about epidemiology. It is about the difficult relationship between our mind and statistics. System 1 is highly adept in one form of thinking. It automatically and effortlessly identifies casual connections between events, sometimes even when the connection is spurious. When told about the high-incidence counties, you immediately assume that these counties are different from other counties for a reason, that there must be a cause that explains this difference. As we shall see, however, System 1 is inept when faced with merely statistical facts, which change the probability of outcomes but do not cause them to happen. The predictability of randomness. A random event, by definition, does not lend itself to explanation, but collections of random events do behave in a highly regular fashion. Imagine a large urn filled with marbles. Half the marbles are red, half are white. Next, imagine a very patient person, or a robot, who blindly draws four marbles from the urn, records the number of red balls in the sample, throws the balls back into the urn, and then does it all again, many times. If you summarize the results, you will find that the outcome 2 red, 2 white occurs almost exactly 6 times as often as the outcome 4 red or 4 white. This relationship is a mathematical fact. A related statistical fact is relevant to the cancer example. For the same urn, two very patient marble counters take turns. Jack draws 4 marbles on each trial, Jill draws 7. They both record each time they observe a homogeneous sample, all white or all red. If they go on long enough, Jack will observe such extreme outcomes more often than Jill, by a factor of 8. The expected percentages are 12.5% and 1.5%. No causation, but a mathematical fact. Samples of 4 marbles yield extreme results more often than samples of 7 marbles do. Now, imagine the population of the United States as marbles in a giant urn. Some marbles are marked KC for kidney cancer. You draw samples of marbles and populate each country in turn, or excuse me, each county in turn. Rural samples are smaller than other samples, just as in the game of Jack and Jill. Extreme outcomes, very high and or very low cancer rates, are most likely to be found in sparsely populated counties. This is all there is to the story. Our predilection for casual thinking exposes us to serious mistakes in evaluating the randomness of truly random events. For example, take the sex of 6 baby boys born in sequence at a hospital. Now, the sequence of boys and girls is obviously random. The events are independent of each other, and the number of boys and girls who were born in the hospital in the last few hours has no effect whatsoever on the sex of the next baby. Now consider 3 possible sequences. And these are done in letters to represent it, but it's boy, 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 girl, girl, girl. That's the first sequence. The second one is girl, 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 girl. And the third one is boy, girl, boy, boy, girl, boy. Are the sequences equally likely? The intuitive answer is, of course not. It's false. That answer would be false because the events are independent, and because the outcomes B and G are approximately equally likely, then any possible sequence of 6 births is as likely as any other. Even now that you know this conclusion is true, it remains counterintuitive, because only the third sequence appears random. As expected, BGBBGB is judged much more likely than the other two sequences. We are pattern seekers, believers in a coherent world, in which regularities, such as a sequence of six girls, appear not by accident but as a result of mechanical casualty or of someone's intention. We do not expect to see regularity produced by a random process, and when we detect what appears to be a rule, we quickly reject the idea that the process is truly random. Random processes produce many sequences that convince people that the process is not random after all. You can see why assuming casualty would have had evolutionary advantages. It is part of the general vigilance that we have inherited from ancestors. We are automatically on the lookout for the possibility that the environment has changed. Lions may appear on the plain at random times, but it would be safer to notice and respond to an apparent increase in the rate of appearance of prides of lions, even if it is actually due to the fluctuations of a random process. The myth of the hot hand. Amos Tversky and his students Tom Gilovich and Robert Vallone once caused a stir with their study of misperceptions of randomness in basketball. The fact that players occasionally acquire a hot hand is generally accepted by players, coaches, and fans. The inference is irresistible. A player sinks three or four baskets in a row, and you cannot help forming the casual judgment that this player is now hot, with a temporarily increased propensity to score. Players on both teams adapt to this judgment. Teammates are more likely to pass to the hot scorer, and the defense is more likely to double team. Analysis of thousands of sequences of shots led to a disappointing conclusion. There is no such thing as a hot hand in professional basketball, either in shooting from the field or scoring from the foul line. Of course, some players are more accurate than others, but the sequence of successes and missed shots satisfies all tests of randomness. The hot hand is entirely in the eye of the beholders, who are consistently too quick to perceive order and casualty in randomness. The hot hand is a massive and widespread cognitive illusion. The public reaction to this research is part of the story. The finding was picked up by the press because of its surprising conclusion, and the general response was disbelief. When the celebrated coach of the Boston Celtics, Red Auerbach, heard of Gilovich and his study, he responded, "Who is this guy? So he makes a study. I couldn't care less." The tendency to see patterns in randomness is overwhelming, certainly more impressive than a guy making the study. The secret of successful schools. I began with the example of cancer incidents across the United States. The example appears in a book intended for statistical teachers, but I learned about it from an amusing article by the two statisticians I quoted earlier, Wehner and Zwirling. Their essay focused on a large investment, some $1.7 billion, which the Gates Foundation made to follow up intriguing findings on the characteristics of the most successful schools. Many researchers have sought the secret of successful education by identifying the most successful schools in the hope of discovering what distinguishes them from others. One of the conclusions of this research is that the most successful schools, on average, are small. In a survey of 1,662 schools in Pennsylvania, for instance, six of the top 50 were small, which is an overrepresentation by a factor of four. These data encourage the Gates Foundation to make its investment in the creation of small schools, sometimes by splitting large schools into smaller units. This probably makes intuitive sense to you. It is easy to construct a casual story that explains how small schools are able to provide superior education and thus produce high-achieving scholars by giving them more personal attention and encouragement than they could get in larger schools. Unfortunately, the casual analysis is pointless because the facts are wrong. If the statisticians who reported to the Gates Foundation had asked about the characteristics of the worst schools, they would have found that bad schools also tend to be smaller than average. The truth is that small schools are not better on average. They are simply more variable. If anything, said Wehner and Zwirling, large schools tend to produce better results, especially in higher grades where a variety of curricula options is available. The law of small numbers is part of a larger story about the workings of the mind. Statistics produce many observations that appear to beg for casual explanations, but do not lend themselves to such explanations. Many facts of the world are due to chance, including accidents of sampling, and casual explanations of chance events are inevitably wrong. And this edition of the briefing was copyrighted in 2011 by Daniel Kahneman, reprinted by permission from Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, all rights reserved. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week, February 10th, 2012. Our first item is entitled, Google, Has It Joined the Dark Side? So much for Don't Be Evil, said Rocky Mirchandani in BostonHerald.com. Google's unofficial motto is now a cruel joke, that is, if you value your privacy. The company is rolling out an aggressive new privacy policy on March 1st, allowing it to combine data on users from all its platforms for the first time. Google will cross-pollinate information from Google searches, emails on Gmail, YouTube videos, posts on Google Plus, and even applications on Android smartphones to create a complete picture of who you are, what you read, where you're going, and what you're up to. The company says the changes will simply allow Google to serve you better, such as by telling you that you're running late for a meeting scheduled on Google Calendar based on your location on Google Maps. But the new policy will also enable Google to create targeted advertising that's based on all your personal data. Scared yet? No one should be shocked, said Jennifer Valentino in WSJ, TheWallStreetJournal.com. People who use free mail, search engines, and social networks have to realize there's no such thing as a free lunch. Google gets 96% of its revenue from ads, and it will thrive only if it creates more effective advertising aimed directly at you. In a sense, Google has no choice but to do this, said Dan Lyons in TheDailyBeast.com. It's competing with Facebook for ad dollars, and the social networking giant has, in effect, built a private internet with its 800 million members. Collecting exclusive detail user data for targeted ads, Google's combative co-founder Larry Page has decided to do the same. Privacy advocates be damned. If you don't like what we're doing with your personal information, Google is effective. Now saying, stop using our product. So let the user beware, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. Google is still insisting that it won't sell your personal data to third parties. But it won't be long before Google changes its privacy policy once again and is selling off our personal information to anyone with a product to hawk or any government agency interested in knowing more about us. Don't say you weren't warned, said Sarah Marie Watson in TheAtlantic.com. Every last digital scrap of you is now being collected for profit. If that policy makes us all question our relationship to the internet giants that govern our lives, perhaps Google isn't wholly evil after all. And the next column, contraception, Obama versus the Catholic Church. It's hard to fathom a government dictate more offensive than this one, said James Capretta in NationalReview.com. President Obama's Health and Human Services Department last week ruled that the Catholic Church and other religious institutions that serve the general public must provide free contraception, sterilization, and abortion-inducing drugs to employees, even if doing so violates the religion's moral teachings. Since they serve non-Catholics as well as Catholics, Catholic universities, hospitals, and charities will now be compelled to subsidize policies that violate church doctrine or face the wrath of a government that is essentially hostile to religious sentiments. This tyrannical attack on religious liberty is ominous and unprecedented, said Jeffrey Cooner in the Washington Times. The president's radical message couldn't be clearer. Abandon Catholic doctrine or go out of business. There's nothing radical about this ruling, said the Minneapolis Star Tribune in an editorial. In multiple decisions, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that religious beliefs do not protect discriminatory practices, and 28 states have policies just like the one just adopted by the federal government. That makes perfect sense. If a church could ban insurance coverage of contraception on religious grounds, what would be next? HIV testing? Vaccines that prevent sexually transmitted diseases? What if a church said its tenants prohibited providing services to black people? The door would be left wide open for eliminating almost anything. Access to birth control is critical because unwanted pregnancies cause serious personal, financial, and social problems. Millions of women of different faiths work for religious institutions in this country, and their access to the same legal health services available to all must trump any claim of religious freedom. And now we'll take a look at a few shorter items as we reach the end of our program. The number of imprisoned men and women aged 65 and over increased by 63% between 2007 and 2010, even as the total U.S. prison population remained essentially flat. The increasing age of the nation's inmates is causing steep rises in health care costs for prison systems. Political donations from wealthy individuals working in the financial services sector jumped 700% over the past two decades. In 2010, those donors contributed $178 million, up from $15.4 million in 1990. Insurers will have to pay out up to $1 billion for the loss of the Costa Concordia. Salvaging the wreck off the coast of Tuscany is estimated to cost more than $50 million and could take 2 years. And after Arizona Governor Jan Brewer was photographed last week in a heated discussion with President Obama over how she portrayed him in her book Scorpions for Breakfast, the book soared from 285,000 to number 21 on the Amazon's bestseller list in a single day. And our poll watch this week, 56% of Americans say they would vote out every single member of the House and Senate if they could. 55% of liberals, 55% of moderates, and 58% of conservatives say they want all members of Congress gone. 80% of all Americans disapprove of the job Congress is doing. 59% of Americans believe Supreme Court justices will allow their ideological views to influence their decisions when they hear a legal challenge to the 2010 health care law. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.